on our own anymore. We have our last guest, Advocate Pilar. Welcome to Parliament and to Max Dolding and to the Ad Hoc Committee on the Appointment of the Public Protector. It's my understanding that you have been nominated for the position.
Thank you very much, Liz. I have been nominated.
Well, let me also congratulate you for having made the top eight candidates without any order of preference who were invited for the interview. As you may be aware, the process is that this committee must then select the best candidate in their view who should be recommended for the position of public protector. So congratulations for having made it thus far. But there's still a road ahead. All right, let me immediately kick off and let me also apologize for the slowness of the pace at which we started, and hopefully you'll be able to forgive us for the inconvenience we may have caused you. Sure. I'll kick off immediately with a general question, and that is that this committee, having looked at your CV, and obviously they must have seen something in it that made them feel that you deserve to be shortlisted and thus be invited for the interview. What is it that you can say about yourself in terms of your qualifications, your past work experience, any other contribution, your convictions, the qualities of your personality, whatever in your view you think confirms that the committee was correct in identifying you as one of the strong candidates for the position? What is it that you believe you would be bringing to the office?
Thank you, Mr. Musita. If I simply look at the act and what the act requires from the incumbent of this post, and if I take that one by one, if I can put that forward, the act firstly requires that the incumbent must be or could be an admitted advocate or attorney for at least 10 years. Now, I was admitted, and forgive me, please, I see there's a typing error on my CV, not 1997, but 1979. I actually attached my admittance certificate, so it's 1979, which makes it 30 years. I was admitted to the bar as an advocate 30 years ago. I was in practice, I was in-house counsel for two legal aid clinics of the then Rand Afrikaans University for 5 years and then for 2.5 years at UNISA, which means that I practiced there. I've appeared in courts every day of my life. So I was actually practicing. After that, I was in a private practice part-time for a year and a half, and since then, for the last 20 years, it will take 3 months, I've been the South African Police Service, a State Department in the legal field. In this legal field, I specialize in various directions. One is in civil claims, for and against the minister, which I was doing on a national level, and then for the last few years now, handling all those in Pretoria. Apart from that, I also specialized during 1992 to 1993 in constitutional law. I had to advise police management on that, and then also in labor law, because I acted as the representative or the employer representative of the South African Police Service for 8 years, doing all the labor cases. So from an advocate point of view, from practicing point of view, I do fulfill that requirement. Over the last 15 years, I also had a pro amico little practice simply to help drug addicts. Martin and I work with young drug addicts, and I appeared in court for them sometimes. I've been in this field for a long time. If secondly, I look at one of the other requirements in terms of the Act is specialized knowledge of or experience in the field of the administration of justice, public administration or public finance. Now, as you can see, I've been in the public service for 20 years and before that semi-public service. And from my CV, it's evident that I haven't been limited only to one department. For the last 3 years at least, I've been representing the South African Police Service in interdepartmental committees with other departments. Most of the time, the only representative, most of these committees on quite a high level. And amongst others, I represented the South African Police Service in the Labor Relations Technical Team, or the technical team that writes the Labor Relations Act. I also have close connections then with the Correctional Services, Departments of Justice, etc. So my experience is over a much wider field than only one state department. If I look at experience inside the public service, it also goes quite wide. I was the National Adjudication Officer for Discipline Matters. I was nationally responsible for all legal work concerning human resources matters, which covers every single field of human resources. For 5 years, I was responsible to write all the policies in the police service, which also range from operational policies such as crime scene management, right through to affirmative action policies, the whole spectrum. So in that instance, I also feel I have quite a wide variety of experience within the public service. Apart from this, I was very involved with dispute resolution. If I look at the Act, I see one of the provisions is that the public protector can resolve disputes by way of conciliation, mediation, and negotiation. Now, in my CV, I added a diploma that I have in alternative dispute resolution, and I'm quite a good mediator. I often use mediation skills to solve problems instead of being confrontational. So that I can also bring to the post a lot of experience on mediation, a lot of experience on negotiation. For 5 years, I was one of the chief negotiators in the Bargaining Council of the Police Service. I've also got that experience. So I believe in trying to solve a dispute by way of mediation rather than confrontation. Of course, if it can't be solved, then there are certain avenues that you have to follow. Then investigation is quite an integral part of the work of the Office of the Public Protector. My involvement with the police service over 20 years, I've got a lot of investigation experience. And not that I've ever been a detective or really investigating, but you look at dockets and you know a lot about investigation. As well as investigation in disciplinary matters, and I mentioned that I'm on a panel of presiding officers for the public service, so also in investigation, I have a lot of experience. If I add to that, the public protector also, as I see in the Act, may make rules. Now here as well, rules have to be gazetted, which are also read in the Act. Here, apart from being on the technical team that wrote the LRA at that stage, I also was either convener or a member of committees writing labor relations regulations, discipline regulations, grievance procedure regulations, the medical aid rules of the Informed Medical Aid Scheme, the code of conduct of the police service. There as well, I feel I can bring something, I can bring experience to this post. The Act also prescribes specific procedures that need to be followed, for instance, for warrants, for search and seizure, also in that field, I've got a lot of experience. I know how to do it, when to do it, how sensitive disease warrants actually are, that you don't just make use to them. I have acted as presiding officer in so many disciplinary matters, so I know how to deal with evidence, how to deal with subpoenas. Also, that experience I can bring. But then, I think something which is quite close to my heart is that both the Constitution and the Public Protector Act states that the public protector must be accessible to all persons and communities. And I think a lot of people already know about public protector, know what public protector can do. But there are still people who don't really know about it. And that I picked up in some of the community projects in which I am involved. We've got a community project in one of the poorest of the poor areas where I've got a legal aid clinic and a counseling service. And here, for instance, I met people who really have nothing. They don't have money to travel to go to the office. They don't even have money to pay for a stamp. And there I realized it doesn't help to sit in an air-conditioned office and wait for people to come to you, but you will have to take awareness to these people because they don't have internal remedies. What I found here is, for instance, that you will have officials that charge people or tell them, come, pay me 500 rand and then I will process your application for a social grant. And that came out in the interviews we had with them in the cases we've done to such an extent that for the last 3 months that I went to this project with, together with my father, actually took along dockets. Because when I got these reports and I had enough to go on, I took statements, I actually opened dockets. I had my own little satellite police station there, which dockets are then registered at Tembo Police Station. Director Mangani is the acting commissioner there, and he said to me, he will send somebody else. But that's the sort of thing that you find. And these people don't really know about something like the public protector. They don't know where to go with it. So I feel that awareness raising and really reaching out to these communities is extremely important. And if you look at my history, I've been involved with communities right from the 1980s where I was instrumental in establishing legal aid clinics in Dobsonville, in Alexandra, etc., and street law projects in Kwatemo, where nobody else would even go in there. We did those projects. So I feel this is an extremely important part of the work of the public protector, and that is something that I can bring to this post and nationally. I think it's very, very necessary. Apart from that, the Office of the Public Protector must be broadly representative of the population of South Africa. Now, government has on many occasions stated that it wants equal representation of males and females. I can bring that. But in addition to that, I think we often tend to forget that representativity and employment equity actually has three cornerstones, right? Gender and disability, and we tend to forget about the disability part of it. Now, to appoint a person with disability, but let me first say, I'll say to somebody else, I don't want my wheelchair to be appointed. I certainly think that I am a suitable person, but in addition to that, appointing a person with disability can bring representativity to that office. South Africa is also a signatory to the International Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disability. I was part of the team that negotiated that, and one of the principles in that convention was actually that the public service should set the example and appoint people with disability, not only on lower levels. For some reason, we keep on appointing people as telephone operators and clerks, etc., while persons with disability have a lot more capabilities. So that, I think, I can also bring from a representativity viewpoint, but that, of course, is just the last part of it. In a nutshell, without repeating my whole CV. I think that is what I can bring to this bus.
I must also say that I am a disability rights activist myself for many years, being partially sighted and using Braille.
You don't find many of them.
So I hope that my judgment is not clouded by my own passion for advancing the cause of equality for disabled people. But thank you for that input. Let me immediately ask you, one of the criticisms that's been leveled against this and other Chapter 9 institutions is that they have a mouth which seems to lack teeth, and therefore they don't bite. Now, I see you are located in an institution which has exactly that, the teeth to bite. I mean, when I grew up, to see somebody in uniform or to see their van was good enough for you to run, even though you don't know why you're running. It's only later when you realize, but there's no reason for me to run, that you start walking. But your first reaction is to run. Wouldn't you be a loss to that arm which has teeth if you were then to be appointed to a body that, in some people's view, actually lacks teeth? In other words, given the challenges we have in the country around crime, around corruption, etc., aren't you just in the perfect slot, given the passion you have, to really advance the aspirations of the people of this country?
Thank you. I'll take that as a compliment. You know, I'm a very small little piece of a very big pixel puzzle. And I think I up to now tried to bring my little part there. Tried to put teeth to it, because the police officer is often being accused of not really putting teeth to it. If I do, we end up in court with all sorts of civil claims, and we have to explain for 2 days in a row why we did so, took a decision for 1 second. However, nobody is not replaceable. And wherever I've been involved in the police service, especially new things that we started, I think I have laid a foundation where anybody else can build on. That there's always somebody who can build on what you've done. I do think that I'm the sort of person who acts. I'm not a sort of person who sits and listens to problems and then says, oh, but we have to do something about it. I actually go and do something about it. One example which you might see in my CV was that, together with the senior magistrates in Pretoria, we established a very active case flow management committee. One of the problems there was that the flow of cases through the courts and the big backlogs we had to do something about that. And that was a mutual thing, because the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development can do what they like. If they don't have the backing of the police service, of detectives investigating, doing their dockets, they can't get it through. Just last week, I sent out a letter, and this is just an example. I sent out a letter to the station commissioners in Pretoria, whether I've got the authority or not, but I use my rank. I sent it out and I said to them, investigating officers whose dockets are not at court must be disciplined. So disciplinary action must be taken against them. Especially says, and then if we find that there's a trend with one investigating officer, that officer can be charged with contempt of court. And if we pick up a trend at a station, the station commissioner will be subpoenaed to court to come and explain why he is not properly leading his station and making sure that dockets are at court. So that's the sort of thing that I implement. And I think that is something, especially if you say that public prosecutor is seen not to really active. With what I have done over the last 3 years in these interdepartmental committees, actually listening to what problems are, investigating, and in every instance implementing remedial steps up to the point of threatening people. And it's not an empty threat. We will do that. We will make one example what happened again. I can bring that to the Office of the Public Protector and also then try and get teeth, because I think it's necessary. The public protector should be seen for what it is, a protector of the public with teeth. If I look at this act, it was actually shocking to see how much power the public protector actually has and what actually can be done, and I think that should be implemented. And that, I think, with my sort of personality and experience, I think I can do that.
Thank you. At least a different view with regard to teeth. You seem to suggest that the teeth are there, it's just that some people don't see them. But finally, from my side, and then I'll allow the rest of the members to take over, and that is to find out if there's anything that you know of about or relating to yourself that you may want to share with the committee that may adversely affect its inclination to select you as their preferred candidate, and if there is such a thing, how you explain yourself around that. In other words, it's confession session. And remember, I just returned from Rome yesterday, having had the privilege of attending Mass conducted by the Pope himself, where he was ordaining Archbishop Nuncio. So just remember that the Pope is behind me, listening in and watching as I'm watching, wherever I'm watching. All right, just on that note.
Thank you, Nadia. It's confession time. No, there's nothing that I'm aware of. I hope people will not see my disability as disadvantaging me. Of course, here and there, I do need a little bit of assistance. I'm quite independent. I can drive my own car, etc. I don't see my disability as a stumbling block. I have learned to simply overcome stumbling blocks. I think it's something else that I can bring to the office. I don't let a stumbling block get into my way, because there's no stumbling block. If you can't get around them, you just go over them. So I have learned to be with that. No, there's nothing, I haven't been sick with crisis, or there's nothing of the kind.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, anyone who wants to ask any questions? Advocate Pinar, Honorable George.
Just one question, Advocate Pinar. I see you, your CV, that you have been defending police litigation, so police acting in a manner or over. Going above board against ordinary citizens. Now, how do you compare your work? You've been working more for what would be called government. Now you must now protect the ordinary person against. How do you think you start from the protecting the government and in the institutions of government, the police, and now protecting the ordinary vulnerable people against, probably sometimes against government action?
Thank you, sir. Just to clarify something, I don't act for police officials in criminal cases. I do handle the interest of the minister. I think it's quite a valid question, but if you look at my background, if you see my involvement with the community project, where I explain to you now that when I see something that goes wrong in a state department, with the grants, for instance, I act. I've also had no problem ever acting against police officials, especially when I work with civil claims. And these civil claims often emanate from very gross infringements on the human rights of people. 60% of our civil claims in Pretoria emanate from unlawful arrest and detention of police officials who still do not understand basic human rights. And I recommend to the Fashion Commissioner that disciplinary action is taken. I think if you just go over to this post, you are still protecting, because by ensuring that constitutional principles are upheld, you are actually also protecting state departments. You are still protecting them. The idea is to make recommendations to assist with remedial steps, and by doing that, I think it's actually a small shift. So I don't foresee any problem in that. You know, when you're a lawyer, today you act for the employer and tomorrow for the employee. So you have to make that shift. You simply do it. I don't foresee any problem there. Maybe because I understand state department, it will be easier for me to recommend remedial steps and to intervene in a mediatory position.
Thank you. Honourable Judge, do you still want to pursue your satisfied? Honourable Michael?
Thanks. Advocate Pinal, you work quite closely with the Minister of Justice. Now, there might be an instance, if you were successful in becoming the public protector, where you would have to investigate the Minister of Justice. How do you think you would deal with any kind of intimidation levied against you by a powerful member of government? That's my first question. And my second question is, how would you bring the public protector to the people, bearing in mind that we're in a recession, and it's not like you're going to be going into a township and building a building with a big sign outside saying public protector. So considering these kind of restraints, how would you push over the stumbling block?
Thank you. You know, in the police service, it reduces the intimidation. You are constantly being intimidated by your seniors sometimes, especially when you have to investigate a senior person. You're prone to it. So that's something that I simply don't allow. I explain to a person that I'm doing my job. I'm not going to follow intimidation. If you want to make a statement of some sort, you're welcome to do it. I'll take it into consideration. But it depends on yourself. I'm not a person who is easily intimidated, and especially not with my work. You often find that with persons that come and complain about an investigation, for instance, from the public, that you have to confront a station commissioner or detective head, and they come up with anything. And I've learned to deal with that by simply being very calm about it and stating that, give me your statement, what is it you want to say? I'll take it into consideration if it is applicable. Otherwise, I'm not going to take it into consideration. Secondly, we are in a recession and we don't want to give up and spend a lot of money. You don't have to go to big buildings. You can go to existing buildings. The project for instance that I've got is a very, very active legal aid clinic. If you go to that community, they've got nothing. What I'm using there is a nursery school with nothing, no water, no electricity, nothing, in the middle of the township. And we just asked the people around there, please just tell them we are coming, and we sent out little flyers, which didn't cost a lot. We made photocopies ourselves. And we said, we are here to help you. We went there, people started coming, they saw what we were doing, and by word of mouth, the message actually went. So we don't need a lot of money to do that, but what we need to do is to go to those communities. As I said, not expecting air-conditioned offices. You don't even need an office. You use whatever you can get in the community. And they are so prepared to make it available if they see that you are bringing a service to them. Because I see the public protector post as a service. It's a service that you are rendering to a community. They're not giving you something. You're giving them something. So that, I think, can be done wherever there are offices of the public protector at very little cost. And you're actually speaking to people. You know, but a lot of those people can't even read or write. You can't send them out flyers. You can't write articles in newspapers. I can't even afford newspapers. You have to physically go there and say, here I am, what can I do for you? And that's where I think, well, in a nutshell, I think proper strategies will be worked out, but it's not going to cost a lot of money.
All right, colleagues, anybody else? Yes, Honorable Njoba.
Thank you, Jefferson. Advocate Pinar. Linda. Okay. Two questions. The first one is the intimidation part. But you have answered it halfway. I'm asking this question because people outside may intimidate everybody, put a gun on you, and then, according to the public protector's job, you need to have a confidentiality. Confidentiality.
Back to the tongue.
Yes. Do you think you may be able to cope with that? That's the first one. The second one is that tomorrow you have given a decision against my brother here. And my brother is totally, totally against your decision or whatever you decided. How would you take it? Would you take it personally? Would you hire people to kill him or kill her or whatever? How would you take it? What would be your impression if you say, you are totally wrong of what you have done to me, you are totally wrong in your decision and so on? How do you react to people who are totally opposed to your decisions? That's my crux of the question. Thank you, sir.
Yes, Advocate, you know.
Maybe to answer the last question first, I'll get back to the intimidation again. You know, in the legal field, you often find that people do not agree with you. There's a saying that says, as many legal people you have in a room, as many legal opinions you are going to have. So it has happened often that people differ from what I have said. I do very proper investigation, and I do very proper and research before I actually get to an opinion. And I'm also quite open. I discuss with a lot of my colleagues before I actually make a decision. But once I've made a decision, and I'm sure that this decision was the correct one, it might even not be, and I don't take it personally. It has happened so often that people really differ from you. If you have stood in a court of law and heard what some of those judges and magistrates actually say to you, you have to get a thick skin. No, I'll be open to hear why the person differs from me. I might learn something from it, but I won't take it personally, no. You know, after all these years of experience, 30 years in the legal field, in the police service, where we often get attacked personally to quite a big extent, you get used to it and you learn to handle it very, very calmly, but to listen. I will most definitely listen to that person. Now, back to the intimidation. I know it's a major problem, but the question is, are you going to allow yourself to be intimidated? And the public protector cannot allow him or herself to be intimidated. So you know you've got the powers, you know that the act is behind you, you know you have to be impartial, and you just don't allow it. You just don't let people intimidate you. I've got some of my seniors in the police service who are extremely intimidating. So you just don't fight back. It doesn't help to fight back with such a person. You very calmly listen to what I've got to say, you turn around and you do your job. That's the way I will deal with it.
Thank you, Honorable Silovo. Is there any other colleague who has a question? Honorable Ndapane?
I understand you are skeptical being called advocate. Well, you are skeptical being called advocate. I'll call you later. Oh, all right. Anything or things you feel that they need to be revisited in the whole office of the Republic Protector for it to achieve its objectives? Can I repeat myself?
Mm-hmm.
Anything or things you feel they need to be revisited or to be looked at in the whole office of the Republic Protector that can make it to achieve its objectives?
So I must be honest and say I'm looking from the outside. I don't know enough of the operation of the office at this point in time to really answer that. I do think that should I be appointed in this post, that I will see how it has been operating to date. I do feel, and I've said that already, that the communities where your poor communities don't know enough about the public protector. I feel very passionate about bringing it to them. So if it has not been done, I will really look at that. Apart from that, you don't go into an office and just change everything. You will go there, see how things have been operating, see where you think changes could take place, and then discuss it with people there and then bring along the changes. I would be very hesitant to go into an office with ideas that I have beforehand that I want to go and implement it. I would rather first go and see what I can build on and then how I can better that. But at this point, I'm specific, apart from bringing it down to the people, and I feel extremely strongly about that, I can have other suggestions.
All right, Honorable Dapane, if that is fine. All right. Any other colleague? Honorable George?
Just one small question. I hope you take it in the spirit I'm asking this question. The question, especially in the light that the majority of those people will be dealing with, especially the vulnerable, will not be speaking, some of them will not be able to speak English. Don't you think that language could be a problem?
We found that in our community project. So what I did is I got students involved. Every time I go there, I've got students from African Institute for Missiology who actually help us with translation. And even some of the people in the community, when I've got a language problem, because it could be a problem, I ask them, come and sit with me here, come and help me, come and explain to me what this person wants to know. So there are ways of overcoming that problem. Wherever you can't always speak all 11 languages. So, yes, of course you have to overcome that, but I make use of whoever is around who can assist. And even look at students, as we've done in our community project, we've got students who assist us with translation. I've also picked up a word or two or three here and there. You get to know some of it. I actually like to learn one of the languages. I think it's necessary. It's a pity we did not have that at school in my day.
All right. Is there any other question, Honorable George?
No,
you're covered. Any other member? We're all happy. All right. What remains for me then is to thank you for your making yourself available and to thank members for all the questions they asked and to do the final act of inviting you to ask any question that you would want to ask the committee or any final comment, if any, that you would want to make before we release you.
Maybe just one question, and that is, are you going to inform the shortlisted candidates of the outcome, or will but we accept if you hear nothing, that's the end of it? And then secondly, when you are planning to do this, because if I should be the person appointed in the bus, I've got quite a lot of wrapping up in my office to do, getting people to represent me, all the committees, etc. So I actually would just like to know, is there any indication of a time frame?
Yeah. First of all, the procedure is that we wouldn't formally communicate back to candidates before the president makes an appointment, because remember, Parliament recommends to the president, and maybe the president might feel that Parliament erred in its decision and may want to have the decision revisited. But we expect that this afternoon, this collective is going to sit and deliberate on all the candidates and finalize its decision on who to recommend to the House. Next week, on the 22nd, the House will then consider the recommendation of the committee. And if it agrees, that name would then be forwarded to the president for appointment. The ideal is that the appointment be effected by beginning of October, because the current public protector's tenure ends on the 15th of October, so that there is the handover from the one to the other. So a situation may arise that the new public protector is has to take office soon after the, within a very short space of time of the president making the appointment. But those are the logistics around which I'm sure when the time comes can be worked around. All right. On that note, thank you very much, and you are released. I'll just ask members to stay on for a minute or two. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. All right, colleagues, we finally reached the end of the process. Yes, Honorable Michael.
Chair, I really was just playing with you earlier by calling me Honorable. Please feel free to call me the
Chair.
It feels silly calling me Honorable Michael. Really, Chair, my name is Nicole. Chair, I'm just a bit confused, and it could well be because I'm a new Member of Parliament, or it could be that I've misread something. But you keep referring to the fact that the President might, when we give him the name that Parliament recommends, might think that he has erred in our decision.
In my understanding, in the public sector, once Parliament has ratified our decision, that decision is final, and that all that the President does is then make the appointment. But he doesn't have the power of review over our decision, and that's why Parliament, a 60% majority in Parliament, that our recommendation must be accepted. Now, of course, that differs with the Human Rights Commission, because the Human Rights Commission needs a simple majority. And if I read that correctly, the President has the right to review on the Human Rights Commission. But with the public protector, the one office that he doesn't have the right to review, all he does is simply effect the appointment.
I will not claim to be an authority on that constitutional one. So whatever view I have is subject to any better opinion. My comments are not in any way suggesting that the President would be able to But it is my understanding that the Constitution, in the founding provisions and in Chapter 1, says that South Africa is a, based on the rule of law. The Constitution takes precedence. And nothing but nothing is valid if it's inconsistent with the Constitution. So I would imagine, purely on that basis, if anything in the process is found to be in conflict with the Constitution or the rule of law, apart from the president, any other interested party would be able to challenge that in open court. And therefore, I would imagine that if the president, in discharging his constitutional responsibilities, were to find something remiss and not, in his opinion, consistent with the Constitution or the law, it would actually be his legal duty, in my view, to bring that to the attention of Parliament. And I would imagine Parliament wouldn't ignore an assertion of that kind. So it is in that broad spirit that I'm putting it. But like I said, I'm not professing to be an expert. I've requested, and that leads to the other point, I requested in the meantime that that we be furnished with a legal opinion on the question whether in law Parliament is required to recommend the appointment, only one person for appointment, or whether Parliament can in fact give the President an option in the sense of giving more than one name, even if it indicates his preferred candidate. The opinion that I have since received is that Parliament in this instance must actually recommend only one name to the President. And so ordinarily the President, as you put it, would simply endorse the recommendation of Parliament. All right. Yes, Honourable Michael.
Just a follow-up question on that, and maybe Tim Nkosi knows the answer to this. Considering 60% of Parliament must agree to sort of the ratification of this name, do we know yet if the Chief Whip or the Speaker of Parliament has called for a three-line whip? Because we run the risk, especially considering we're going into recess next week, unless it's declared a three-line whip, of not having a quorum to approve the name.
I established that yesterday, that contrary to what I had thought, this matter is not gonna, it's not going to serve before the House tomorrow, but it will definitely serve before the House, as you yourself indicated, next week, Tuesday. And one of the reasons is that all matters that require a three-line whip have been grouped together into one day so that the three-line whip can apply both in respect of this matter and this, and also in respect of the other matter of the appointment of commissioners to the Human Rights Commission. So it is my understanding that the ruling party is aware of its constitutional responsibility of delivering a quorum, which hopefully would be equally supported by the opposition parties to enable Parliament to reach the necessary majority to exercise its discretion. All right. Any further matters that need to clarity? All right. We have concluded a marathon of interviews. I'm sure you'll all agree with me. congratulations for all the hard work and for sticking it out, so to speak, and not chickening out somewhere in the middle. It means that you are true soldiers. None of you committed mutiny. otherwise, you are going to be charged with high treason. All right. As chairperson, I really appreciate the cooperation that we received. I assume that we will, during our lunch break, which will take immediately now, go and deliberate within our own caucuses or whatever, study groups. And hopefully when we resume after lunch, we will come with a common name so that we don't have to go through any form of mediation, conciliation. Hope not arbitration. All right. So I think the way we'll do it is that we'll put across our thoughts and work through the names, and hopefully in the process eventually agree on a consensus name. That would be the ideal. So let's go and have our break and give it a thought and come back and see what we can come up with. Anything else that anybody wants to raise before I adjourn this meeting? Can I propose, it's almost 2 o'clock, I'm sure you'll want your full hour of a break before you come back. So shall we say we resume at 3 o'clock? And then you can even go into the house briefly if you so wish. I see the bells are already ringing. But 3 o'clock, can we all be here by all means? All right? Thank you. Yes. There is a three-line whip that I am declaring with immediate effect for 3 o'clock. We were in the room.